All right. So good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're going to have a chat about Active Directory integration with Office 365. My name's Ross Adams. I'm a senior program manager. I work in the what we'll call the core engineering team of Windows Azure Active Directory. Just a quick show of hands. How many people made it to the lap around Windows Azure Active Directory? A couple. Okay. So really what we're going to be talking about today is how Office 365, which is built sort of on top of that directory, how you integrate your on-premise directory to it, as well as a little overview of some of the other pieces. So we'll talk about the architecture of Windows Azure Active Directory as seen from Office 365 and other services. So Intune is a good example of that. We'll look at the different integration options. So there's varying levels of integration you can go through from just directory data all the way through to a single sign-on. We'll look at what you need to do to plan and prepare for directory integration on your on-premise environment. We'll certainly walk through the sign-in experience, what it actually means, the way that it works. So how does this actually work from a technology perspective? And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the options for strong authentication. So if you have strong auth, smart cards, these types of things on-premise, how do you actually get that up into the cloud? So Windows Azure Active Directory, we have a couple of different types of accounts that we deal with. We deal with what we'll call cloud accounts. So these are accounts that are created wholly and solely in the directory in the cloud, no level of integration. And we offer a couple of things there. You can set passwords to never expire. So you can effectively bypass the reset my password every 90 days. You can also turn off complexity. So you can make sure passwords are simple, don't require upper and lowercase. And recently we added password policy. So this is the ability to take a cloud-based account and set the password policy to 90 days, 100 days, 20 days, those sorts of things. And then when you get actually notified for those password changes. We also have what we'll call single sign-on with your corporate credentials. Single sign-on is a very overly used term, but I'll explain in some depth what that actually means for the different products and the different client types. And we're going to spend a fair amount of time walking through the technical details of this. We also offer role-based administration. So we have sort of five core roles that we have within Azure Active Directory. First, you've got the company admin. They're allowed to do anything they like. They can buy new stuff, they can create users, delete users, and so on. And then the billing admin is there, obviously, to do the purchase side, as well as your user account admins. Now, user account admins can create users and delete users and reset passwords, where the help desk admin can only reset a password. The service support admin is a special role. It's for partners. It's the way that partners come into the system so that they can manage it. Okay. So these roles are there in order to help you manage the tenancy without requiring special groups. So how do we actually provision? And there's sort of three ways of provisioning. So you can have a manual provisioning. So you would have seen the portal. So in Office 365, there's a portal. That portal provides that simple web user interface. It has a bulk upload capability. And it's really designed for the smaller organizations. There's a scriptable process, okay? So you can use a couple of different ways of scripting data in. You can use the PowerShell module that comes for Windows Azure Active Directory, and currently labeled Microsoft PowerShell module for Office 365. There's a new interface coming as well, which is our new REST-based API. Okay? And our REST API is really, as Victoria went through in the Leparound AD, is really based on the graph, the directory graph setup. It does have some limits on what you can do today. We are working on expanding that, but as it is today, there's a limited set of attributes you can edit, and there's a limited set of objects you can create. And then we have an automated provisioning system, and the automated provisioning is really the first level of our directory integration. It's effectively a directory sync, so taking data from on-premise and syncing that into the cloud, automatically offering that Delta experience as well. It's got a full fidelity of attributes and object types, so it will create everything. It will set all the member links, all of the manager links, and so on. And it's really optimized for larger data sets. So what does this look like from an architectural perspective? And if you like, we have up in the cloud, we have Windows Azure Active Directory. and has a couple of different places, components to it. So we have an authentication platform where if I'm using a cloud-based identity, it will be the identity provider, my IDP. Okay. We have the directory store where we store all the profile data. Groups, users, members of groups, manager links are all stored in that directory store. There's a provisioning platform which effectively allows us to do a lot of the workflow. And we have a couple of different ways into it. So we have the admin portal and PowerShell, and the REST API comes in as well. So if I'm just using effectively cloud accounts, I have no integration, and I only require those services in the cloud. If I decide that I want some level of integration, I can go to what we'll call a directory data-only type of integration, sort of that first level, where if I have a directory on-premise, I can install the directory sync tool. And that directory sync tool allows me to provision my users automatically up into the cloud, into the directory, as well as the authentication platform. And then based on my licensing type, if I purchased Office 365 with all of, all of the services, my user will flow into all of those different services. Okay. And as you can see there, these services all have a trust with that identity platform. So they are all expecting to get that token from there. I can go to a third level, which is effectively directory and single sign-on. Then I install ADFS on-premise, and you'll notice that when I do that, my identity provider moved from the cloud to on-premise, and I now have a trust with the authentication platform. All right. Now, directory sync is very important that we include that in the single sign-on process so that we still get that shadow account or that little account up there on the authentication platform. It just doesn't have a password anymore. It now has effectively a link between the on-premise directory user and the cloud-based shadow account, we'll call it. So why go ahead and do all of this? So there's a couple of good reasons for this. It's a single place for management. So if you go down and you say, I'm going to do directory integration and I want single sign-on, then I'm going to get a single place for all management. So not only users groups, security groups, manager links, attributes, all of the directory data, but also on passwords and password policies. So for example, passwords in the cloud are between 8 and 16 characters and can't have a space. Okay, but if you have SSO or single sign-on configured with directory integration, you'll end up with whatever password policy you like. All right? You're truly verifying the password on-premise. There's no restriction now that the cloud imposes on that password. You get support for all the enterprise single sign-on, so a true single credential to get access to all of the services. There's no password sync involved. Your authentication is purely on-premise. We also then get support for the hybrid scenarios. So if you want to do Exchange hybrid, it requires that you have directory sync, and single sign-on makes that a much easier experience. The same will be true when other hybrid solutions come out. And you introduce options for strong authentication. So without single sign-on and directory integration, there are no choices right now for any strong authentication. It's all based on username and password only. So with SSO, I now get some options around single sign-on, around strong auth, and I'll walk you through what those are. So if we kind of summarize this down and we look at the data that exists, the levels of integration, there's sort of these pros and cons, if you will. So as I said, no integration. Effectively, I have no on-premise Active Directory to integrate with. It's great for smaller organizations. There's no requirement that you have any hardware whatsoever on-premise. Of course, no single sign-on, no strong authentication options. If you're logging onto your PC with a username and password, it will be a separate credential to the cloud, and they're maintained separately. And everything in this case is mastered on-premise. There's no mastering of any data everything here is mastered in the cloud. There's no mastering of any data on-premise. If you go ahead and do just level two, if you like, we have just the directory synchronization tool. It's good for the sort of small to medium, or medium to large. When we say small to medium, we're sort of thinking up to about 500 seats. Once you get above 500 seats, it's almost universally people running directory sync. So it's good. It gives you a single point of management for all of your on-premise directory data. Okay. It does enable some of the coexistence scenarios. It does require a single server on-premise. Okay, not highly available, but a single server. You don't get any single sign-on. You kind of get two sets of credentials, although it's a bit like a credential and a half, in that the username from on-premise will match the username in the cloud, but the passwords are managed independently. Okay, as I said, it's a single server to deploy this. So if you go ahead and add to that SSO, single sign-on, then it's generally larger organizations. We see about 80% of Directory Sync customers also run single sign-on. You get all the benefits now. You get single sign-on with a corporate credential, so it is a true single identity. There's no password sync to the cloud in any of the models. Everything is mail-mastered on-premise. So password policies, all of the account data, everything is mastered on-premise. You have complete control over it. Some two-factor also, some strong authentication options open up with this model. It enables the hybrid solutions as opposed to sort of coexistence solutions. And you can also do things, for example, to control where a user can access services. So if you have restrictions on users not being able to access services outside of the corporate network, if you add SSO with Directory Sync, you can offer those sorts of things. There's a fairly, there's a con to all of this, of course. There's a cost. That cost is you need to, because you're dealing with the authentication, you need to make sure you have a highly available deployment of ADFS, as we'll walk through. And that's necessary because you are the identity provider. So when on-premise is the identity provider, if I can't talk to on-premise, then I won't be able to log in. Okay, so that's why we need to make sure that we have this highly available set of ADFS servers. So what's generally required? So we'll walk through some of these requirements. How do I get all this good stuff? What do I have to have on-premise? So on-premises, you have to have your functional AD Forest functional level of 2003 or above. Okay, that's a requirement from ADFS. The ADFS 2.0, just a note, Windows 2008 and above includes an ADFS version. It's version 1. We need version 2. It's a free download on top of Windows 2008. Okay. Windows 2003 for a directory synchronization, this is the actual hardware that it'll run on. Directory Sync will run on 2003 in a 32-bit only. We are trying to deprecate the 32-bit version, so we'd suggest running it on Windows 2008 or above using that 64-bit version. There's some performance gains in there as well. Both of these products do support virtualization. Of course, they come with making sure that the virtualization has sufficient capacity for them. And generally speaking, there is it's a single forest-based solution for directory synchronization. It can be multiple domains within a single forest, but we're confined to the boundaries of that single forest. Multi-forest support is something that we're working through right now through Premier engagement. So if you have a multi-forest environment, you can certainly contact your Microsoft representative and discuss the options for syncing and single sign-on within that multi-forest environment. So what do I need to do with my on-premise data in order to get this to move forward? So the very first thing, as I said before, and you'll hear me say this quite a lot, is designed for that high availability of the ADFS services. Okay, it's very important. If it's not available, you will not be able to log in. Okay. Generally speaking, we'll say every user must have a UPN, a user principal name. We do some things where we make up user principal names. Making up things is often confusing for the user, and that's why we suggest that everybody have one of these user principal names that is defined and they understand. All right? They will need this in order to be able to log in. So within that, there's a set of verified domains. So if you have a .local domain, you're going to have some issues. You're going to need to rename the UPN suffix. So that UPN suffix, you know, user@contoso.com, needs to make sure it's something you can prove you own and is verified within Office 365. Then you have the UPN characters. We're a little restrictive, more restricted than Active Directory on UPN characters. We support letters, and this is alphanumeric, if you will. So this is A through Z, none of the, extended character sets. Numbers and a set of symbols there, dot, dash, underscore, bang, and a few others. There is a restriction on dot. You can't have a dot immediately before the at symbol. So as you can see there, ross.adams is fine, but ross.adams.junior dot, that second dot, is going to cause you grief. Users, when they get prompted for authentication, are going to have to be able to type in that UPN. And this is why, again, we say they should have one. It should be set. So it's deterministic of what it is. And you should be able to tell the user. Generally speaking, it helps if it matches their email address. Now, there's a tool. There's some other restrictions. We don't allow duplicate proxy addresses in the cloud. We don't allow duplicate UPNs, these types of things, where they can exist on-premise. They're not necessarily allowed, but they can exist there. And there's a tool called the Office 365 Deployment Readiness Tool. Strongly recommend that before moving or attempting to synchronize data, run this tool. It'll give you a good idea of what problems you're likely to hit and where you need to go and fix those things. So, what happens when we synchronize this data up into the cloud? As I said, there's a bunch of validation that we do when we run through. And there's some differences in the way we deal with a user who has a license and a user that doesn't have a license. So firstly, users that have licenses, all of their proxy addresses, so all of their email addresses that are defined within that proxy address attribute must be against a verified domain. So, for example, if I have contosa.com in my proxy addresses on-premise, but in the cloud, I haven't proved yet that I own contosa.com, as soon as I give the user a license, we will strip those SMTP addresses away. And we effectively drop them. Okay. For the UPN, if the user was also had a UPN at contosa.com, we would ignore that, and we would give them a cloud-based identity, the onmicrosoft.com domain. So in that instance, we need to, once we verify the domain, proxy addresses will automatically come back to life for the user. But UPN, if we don't have single sign-on, if you have single sign-on, we will automatically update the UPN. However, if you don't have single sign-on configured for the tenant, then, or for that particular domain, then we won't automatically fix the user principal name. It will remain in the onmicrosoft.com domain. And the reason we do that is because it's a non-deterministic change. Okay? When the user is actually typing, ross at contosa.onmicrosoft.com to log in, if I was to just change their username on them without necessarily coordinating that with the user, they wouldn't be able to log in correctly. So we force people to either update that manually unless you move to single sign-on. If you move to single sign-on, the client will automatically try and log in using that contosa.com address. And because of that, we automatically update it for them. If you have unlicensed users, so users that you never plan on licensing, vendors in the organization, external contacts, their SMTP address can be against any domain you like. All right. There's nothing that we do there special for their email addresses. The SIP address, however, we will drop unless it is against a verified domain. So, and as I said there, if you add another domain or you verify a domain after the initial sync, we will go back and fix any SMTP or SIP addresses automatically for all of the users in the tenancy. So when we set up directory sync, we're going to come up against two options. The first option, a one-way sync. Okay. So basically this is take all of the data that I have on-premise. We drop a few users. We obviously drop well-known, particularly well-known SIDs. So we drop the administrator, the everyone group. We also don't synchronize system objects. Okay. So in this case, we'll take all the regular users, no filtering of any of this data, and pull it into the cloud. We also pull all of the attributes. We have about 70-odd attributes that we synchronize from on-premises up to the cloud. That's one-way sync. You can move to a two-way sync. All right. You can move from one-way to two-way, but not from two-way back, as we'll get to in a minute. And everything is mastered on-premises. So if you have, for example, a user and you set their display name on-premises and they get synced into the cloud, and when you go into the cloud, we won't allow you to update that value. Okay? If we did, we'd automatically override the top of it. So in this case, we block your ability to do that. Whatever object is on object and property are synced from on-premises are always mastered in that location. If you decide to go with a two-way sync, and the two-way sync is really for certain Exchange hybrid scenarios, all right, what it effectively means is it allows us to deal with some of the richer coexistence models for Exchange Online. So if I want to be able to permanently keep a set of users on-premises and another set in the cloud, and maybe I want to swap the users backwards and forwards, I want to make sure that, for example, my safe sender list works correctly. So mail is being received on-premises, and I've got users in the cloud. We synchronize back the safe sender list. So in this case, the safe sender list for the users in the cloud, when they say allow email from this or block this domain, by synchronizing it back to on-premises, the safe sender list is active. All right? Without that two-way sync, their safe sender settings never get back to the point where the mail is being received and therefore never come through. So it's a richer experience for the cloud to the cloud and on-premises. Now, when you turn this on, these attributes that we sync back, there's five of them that we sync back, they are now mastered in the cloud for those users. Okay, you can change them on-premises, but we will override them. All right. So there is only ever a single master in this model. One-way sync, everything is mastered on-premises, the cloud trusts on-premises. In the two-way sync, most of the data is mastered on-premises, some is mastered in the cloud. All right. Now here it says you can't move back to one-way sync. This is true. You can move back to one-way sync if you decide to uninstall directory sync and install it again. But there's not an easy option to flip where there is in the one-way to two-way. So as it says there, cloud becomes the master. There's some UM integration as well if you have Link on-premise and Exchange in the cloud and want to do some of the UM integration features. So as I said, there's a few things when you configure this. We will sync all objects by default. There's some exceptions, as I said. There's the default administrators group, the everyone, so these well-known SIDs that we won't pull into the cloud. And we never synchronize anything from the system objects, anything that's marked as a system object. We also don't sync from any other container other than the domain container. We don't pull any data from the configuration containers. Right. And you can turn it off. So if you decide that I have an on-premises directory, I'm going to use it to synchronize everything into the cloud, and then I decide I don't want my on-premise directory anymore, I'm just going to use the cloud-based one. You can do that. So you can turn off directory sync. Now, the turn-off takes a bit of time. All right? It can take, depending on the size of the organization, up to about 72 hours. And the reason being for that is we flip, effectively, the source of authority. So we take the data that was existing in the cloud, which is currently set to say, I'm not authoritative for this. It's going to be coming from on-premises. So you can't edit it up here. You have to do it on on-premise. When you turn off directory sync, we flip that so we say, the cloud is now the master of all of this data. All right? And then we allow you to edit that. And you can turn it back on again. So if you turn directory sync back on, we match everything back up again and we start moving forward. It's not a good idea to turn it on and off. All right? Generally speaking, leave it on and let it run. There's no good reasons now to actually turn it off other than I don't want to use on-premise anymore. So there's a few things that you can't change right now, particularly around the scoping of an attribute set. So we sync about 70 attributes, as I said. A lot of them are MS Exchange-based attributes. And if I was using something, say, Intune or Link maybe offers subscription service, something that doesn't care about Exchange, I might want to limit that set and only sync, you know, sort of the core pieces. Unfortunately, we don't support that today. It'll sync whatever it can find in the directory up into the cloud. And we'll apply validation rules to all of those things. So the deployment readiness tool I mentioned before will do a check against all attributes, even if you may not be using them in the cloud. And it syncs every 3 hours. So it'll do an initial sync. 3 hours later, it'll try and do a delta sync. So it'll look for all the changes that have occurred in that hour, 3 hour window, synchronize them up into the cloud. Okay? And if there's an error creating a user, or there's an error setting an attribute, it will retry automatically in the next sync interval. Okay? And we send you emails to tell you. So monitor the technical contact for these emails that we send back. So what happens when I deploy single sign-on? What sort of an experience do I get from the different clients? And each client behaves just a little differently, unfortunately. And there's three of them. Here we've got two of the examples. So there's the what I call the rich clients, and then there's web clients. Rich clients, in this case, are clients that utilize the Microsoft Online Sign-In Assistant. Okay. An example of that would be Link Online, the Office subscription services use it, as well as CRM Online, okay? The rich client that comes with CRM. They all use the Microsoft Online Sign-In Assistant. And if I'm on a domain join machine on the corporate network, effectively line of sight to the ADFS backend, then I'll get a very integrated experience. I'll fire off Link, for example. All of my services currently run in our dog food cloud. When I fire off Link in the morning, I get an integrated experience. It just signs me in silently. I never see a prompt from Link. All right. It does connect directly to the back end. So you'll see in a little while, I'll walk you through how this actually works under the hood. It's a direct connection to the ADFS server. Internally, externally, I'll connect through the proxy. Web-based applications. So these are, interestingly enough, these are SharePoint Online, the OWA experience, as well as the Office-rich applications. So Word, Excel, PowerPoint, all of these applications actually throw up a Trident window that actually is web-based auth. Okay? So whilst you would think of Word as a rich client, it's really a web-based client currently. And they prompt for a username. So if I'm on a domain joined machine on the corporate network, it's going to prompt me for my username first. That prompt for username is so we can do what we call realm discovery. So typing that username in allows the authentication platform to decide what to do for authentication. So if you're a cloud-based user, it says, great, I know you're a cloud user, give me a password and I'll authenticate you. If you've configured the domain for single sign-on, then it'll prompt you for or effectively gray out the password box and then send you off to your ADFS server for authentication. Okay. Here's a keep me signed in tick box. That keep me signed in will give you a long-lived token for about 24 hours that allows you to go through and bypass this initial click. Unfortunately, the realms are different. So if, for example, you tick this box for SharePoint Online, it will work for all of the other IE sessions, so it'll work with SharePoint Online and Exchange OWA, but Word, Excel, PowerPoint will prompt you again. And in those cases, they have a keep me signed in as well. The clients in this case will actually connect directly to, you know, on the corporate network, they'll connect directly to the back-end ADFS infrastructure. Outside, they'll connect to the proxy. Now, on a domain joined machine, corporate network, you'll get an integrated experience once you've typed your username and get to the ADFS server. You will get an integrated experience. You won't be prompted for a password now. Externally, you can get different options. And there are some options around trying to bypass some of these prompts. So things like Outlook do a really good job of providing what we call a smart link. So by providing a www.outlook.com, with a WAC contosa.com on the end of it, that tells the identity, it tells Exchange to send to the identity platform, this user belongs to Contoso. When we do that, the identity platform actually figures out that you're a federated namespace and redirects you automatically to the ADFS server. So you never see that initial prompt for username. You can do the same thing for SharePoint Online. However, when you send a deep link in SharePoint, so if you take a link to a document and send it to a user, that unfortunately isn't possible to smart link that. Okay, it will remain as a prompt for username experience. So how does Exchange Online handle this? Exchange Online is different in the way that it handles authentication. It's often referred to as Exchange Proxy Auth. Okay, and effectively what it's doing is taking basic credentials and taking those basic credentials and relaying them through the identity platform across to the, and then eventually across to the ADFS proxy. And the Exchange Online always uses the ADFS proxy. And this is because Exchange Online is always remote to the ADFS servers. And it'll always prompt for both username and password. And there's a couple of reasons for that. These devices are reasonably dumb. Okay, smartphones don't understand Kerberos, they don't understand token-based auth, but they do understand basic auth. So Exchange's needs to make sure that it supports that. There are some controls that you have because of this. So if you have controls or if you require client isolation, you can do that with Exchange Online. It allows you to do that based on the client IP, the device type, and the Exchange endpoint. And we'll walk through that in a second. So this is kind of a summary of what I've just been rolling through there. So for rich applications where they're based on the sign-in assistant, you'll get username and password prompts. If you're on a non-domain joined machine, it's a username and a password prompt. But it is the AD credential. All right, it is not a different credential than the user uses to log into their PC. Single sign-on, domain join PC, corporate network, all the way through. And you can actually save those credentials if need be. Web clients, again, username and password for cloud. AD credentials, non-domain joined, you will be prompted for both. First username, and then you get prompted for username and password by the ADFS server, but they are your AD credentials. In an SSO environment, you will get prompted for that realm discovery, and then your AD credentials will be sent automatically. And then the Exchange clients, username and password. The only difference being it's always, in a single sign-on case, your AD credential. There's not a separate credential. And they can be saved as you go through. So some of the specific details of what we've got here, we are using a WS star or a WS, we use WS Fed and WS Trust when we set up our SSO integration. So we use WS Federation for passive clients. WS Trust provides our support for rich clients. Okay, and it's today we're only supporting it through ADFS 2.0. We are looking at expanding that, but as it is today, it's ADFS 2.0. We also use a SAML 1.1 token for those who care, but there's three things that we stick in a SAML token that are very important. There's this issuer URI, and the issuer URI is used by us to locate the certificate to verify the token. Okay. If you have multiple domains, then there's work that you need to do in order to make sure you send the right issuer URI. And I'll talk some more about that in a little while. There's a user source address. It's an immutable ID. It's a unique, never-changing identifier of the user. It's one, when I said earlier, we create this shadow account in the authentication platform. That shadow account is actually looked up and mapped by the use of this unique identifier. And we also send the user principal name. Okay. So if I look at the different ways that different clients connect, and if I look at a ADFS server on premises and then the proxy acting as my gateway, you can see here that if I have clients that are Link, Office Subscription Services, or OAuth, they all, if they're on the corporate network, will through do a lookup for the same name, find that, and talk to the back end directly. Okay. If I have Exchange Online and I use any client, be it Outlook, IMAP, POP clients, ActiveSync, regardless of how they connect, they'll always send basic username and password to Exchange Online, who will then send that through to the active endpoint. Okay. And that active endpoint is effectively allows us, active endpoint effectively gets additional information. They get the client IP, and this is the client IP that Exchange saw. So if you have an proxy, for example, on your corporate network, Exchange will see, generally speaking, that gateway address as it comes out. They also tell you the protocol. So in this case, the RPC, ActiveSync, AutoDiscover, there's about 15 different protocol endpoints that you can be, SMTP, et cetera. And they'll also tell you the device type. Okay? So they'll tell you, you know, effectively the device string of the object. And all of these things, once they go through the active endpoint, can then be propagated into claims that you can write then as issuance rules within ADFS. Okay. As you can see there, externally, my other clients will connect to the proxy as well. So if I want to be able to filter out access, so how many people have a requirement to filter access to Office 365 services based on where a client is? Two. Very small number. Well, what we effectively do is, as I said, the endpoints can be turned on and off within ADFS. So I can turn off the MEX endpoint. Turning off the MEX endpoint will turn off all of my rich clients, the ones that use the sign-in assistant. I can also turn off the web clients as well. If I want to actually be able to target it through, I can actually go through and block all of extranet access by turning it all off. The unfortunate part of that is, because Exchange is always external, I need to be able to define rules around that. And this is where these headers come into play. So I can write rules that allow me to block particular clients. So I can say ActiveSync is good, but I'm going to block Outlook if unless it comes from my corporate network. And we have some examples in the link below there as well. We give examples for only certain clients, web clients only, as well as sort of Outlook on the corporate network. That does require an ADFS proxy. There is no replacement for it. And then we allow external access for a particular group of users as well. So you can allow your execs in and deny everybody else. Unfortunately, any of these rules will cause link to or offer subscription services to fail when they're external. Because they effectively don't send the information necessary to be able to bypass those particular rules. So there's some requirements around third-party proxies. Certainly that link has some good data in it. So how does this actually work? What happens when I'm walking through and actually exchanging tokens between the different systems? So here I have the authentication flow for a passive client. So using the web profile, and my client's on a domain join machine, corporate network, and is hitting Exchange Online. So they're going to go across to Exchange Online. Exchange Online says, I can't do anything with you. I need a token. That token I'm going to get for you comes from the authentication platform. So they'll redirect the client to the authentication platform. The client gets the authentication platform. They do realm discovery at this point, either by typing their name or using that smart link. Once they do that and they type their name, the authentication platform says, I know who you are, but I can't authenticate you. You need to go to your ADFS server, and here's a link. Please follow that. So the client gets that link back, happily follows that up to the ADFS server. A little bit of back and forth, some username and password, travels through ADFS, gets a 401, challenges you, Kerberos auth, and does a quick look up inside Active Directory. And what it gets back from Active Directory is a couple of things, that UPN, as we said before, as well as a pretty key point, the source user address, which is a AD object GUID base 64 encoded is the default value that we use for that particular attribute, something that you can't change very easily at all. So it comes back to the client. The client follows that URL back to the authentication platform. And based on the issuer URI in there, it does a verify of this logon token. If that verification succeeds, it replaces it with an auth token. And this is what their services are looking for. And the services really don't care how you get that token. In fact, Exchange Online in this case has no idea how you got that token, whether you typed a username and a password or not. It's just basically saying you must have a token from issued by this guy. So once that token comes back to the client, they now have the right data. They'll send it over to Exchange Online. Exchange Online takes that auth token, does the lookup, and returns the data. So this time, we'll roll through what we call the rich clients or the MEX endpoint. So this is the metadata exchange endpoint, and it's a little more complicated. So I start off and I sign into my PC in the morning, prompts Control-Alt-Delete, username and password. When I log onto the machine, the sign-in assistant says, oh, I know who, somebody new just logged in, so I'm going to take your UPN, and we do a couple of lookups for that. We do a standard NT call in order to be able to get your UPN. And if we can't, we'll make one up. And this is where making things up is not necessarily to our advantage. Let's assume it's set. What it's going to do is take that UPN, and it's going to send it over to the authentication platform and do realm discovery. Once it's done realm discovery, it's going to send that information, because it knows your ADFS integrated, off to the ADFS MEX endpoint. Excuse me. So once it does that, it gets back from the MEX endpoint. I don't have this in my animation, but it gets back from the MEX endpoint a list of available endpoints. It's going to choose the Windows Integrated Auth endpoint or the Windows Transport endpoint. Excuse me. And then it's going to prompt you for authentication, challenge you. You'll send through Kerberos tickets, etc. It'll eventually get you back a logon token. And you can see this logon token contains exactly that same set of data. Comes back, fires it off to the authentication system. The authentication system looks you up, verifies the token, matches up the user, and converts your token to an auth token and sends it back to you. And this all happened when you logged in. Okay? There's no no application currently running. This is just the sign-in assistant, which is running as a service, and doing this on your behalf when you log into the system. Then when you fire off a client like Link, Link says, great, I know where to go to get Link Online. I'll hit Link Online. Link Online says, I can't help you. Must have token. Unfortunately, I've got that authentication token already because I'd already been through the dance with the authentication platform in ADFS, and I just send it over to the Link Online system, who then verifies the token, looks me up, and gives me access. So how does Exchange do this? So now we have what we'll call the active endpoint. And this is how Outlook and ActiveSync, they're always external. So in this case, my ADFS server is really on the edge. It's actually a proxy, but we'll simplify my model. So I log into my PC, nothing happens. If I've got the sign-in assistant, it'll do its song and dance at the back, but it really has no impact on us as far as Outlook is concerned. When I fire Outlook off, Outlook is going to fire off, and it's going to prompt me for a username and password. It's going to hit Exchange Online, who's going to say, no, you have to give me basic auth. Okay? And Outlook will then prompt me for basic credentials. And I'm going to get that basic credentials of basically a username and a password. I'm going to take that, send it over SSL over to Exchange Online. And Exchange Online says, okay, thank you very much for those credentials. I can't do anything with them. I have no way of verifying them. But I know who does. So it creates a little shadow copy of you, a little proxy, if you will, and it takes the UPN of that and sends it to the authentication platform and says, do you know this user? What am I supposed to do with them? The authentication platform in this case comes back and says, they're federated. There's an ADFS server on the other side of this. So now they've got the ADFS endpoint. They take those basic credentials and they fire them at the ADFS server's active endpoint, the username mixed endpoint. The ADFS server, in this case the proxy, passes it through to the back end. The back end then verifies that username and password and does a lookup. It ends up getting back, my little mouse works, it ends up getting back that same logon token. Okay? There's no difference in it. That logon token has that UPN and the source user address. It comes back to Exchange Online. Exchange Online can do nothing with this. It doesn't know how to actually crack that token. So it sends it back to the authentication platform. The authentication platform says, great, I'll verify the token, all things considered, I'm going to issue an auth token, and I'll get that auth token back to Exchange Online. Now, Exchange Online has its auth token. That's what it needed. That's what it wanted in order to be able to do the authorization check. It gets that data. It now verifies it, effectively drops the shadow account or the shadow representation of you, now it knows who you are, and sends back the data to the client. All right. And that's why Exchange Online always requires this proxy, okay? In that it's going to always exchange requires the ADFS proxy, because it's always trying to proxy it through the remote endpoint. So some Active Directory structural considerations here. So if I look at what I have inside, and these are sort of, I'll call ROSisms, if I look at the different structures I have, as we said, if I have, depending on the domain type that I have, I may or may not have to do special work, okay? So if I have a matching domain, and this is really my internal Active Directory is called contosa.com, my external name is contosa.com, and I want to be contosa.com. Everything matches up, and there's really nothing special you have to do here. It's the simplest of deployments. If I have subdomains, there was a recommendation Microsoft made a while back that said, hey, rather than creating sort of matching domains, contosa.com for your internal as well as external, you could use a subdomain. Microsoft, for example, go down this path. We are corp.microsoft.com, and externally we are microsoft.com. If you do that, then it's very important on the way and the order of registration. So this is about verifying these domains, and what you effectively want to do is verify that top-level domain first. And when you do that, all of the children underneath it will inherit from that parent. So I'll verify contosa.com, I'll make it federated, then corp.contosa.com will be federated. Okay? Sales.corp.contosa.com would be federated. So it's important that you register that top-level domain first, otherwise you'll end up in a slightly different place. How many customers have a .local domain? Excellent. How many .locals also have smart cards? Excellent. There's usually one that I have to talk to specially. So if you have a .local domain, you can't prove you own it. So if you're contosa.local or contosa.internal or contosa.ad or something of this nature, which there is no public DNS for, you can't prove you own it. If you can't prove you own it, you can't use it in the cloud. So what it really means is that that UPN address is not going to be usable in the cloud. So you have to come up with a new one. All right. Generally, the easiest way to do that is to make it the user's SMTP address, make it match their mail address. All right. There are some issues with changing users' UPNs, all right. It's particularly around smart cards. If you have smart cards or certificates in general, they use the UPN as the subject name. So if you change the UPN, you have to get new certificates. So, but it does require, if you're using a .local and you want to go to a single sign-on model and you want to be able to use that, you are going to need to get new UPNs for all of the users. How many customers have multiple top-level domains, contosa.com, fabricam.com? No? A couple? Okay. So in this case, there's some extra pieces you need to do. And this is really about being able to reutilize the same ADFS server farm to be able to handle multiple top-level domains. So as I said before, the issuer URI is what defines who the certificate that comes through for token verification. So how do I verify that this actually came from the ADFS server I like? And if you've got multiple top-level domains, ADFS by default will only send one issuer URI, a default issuer URI. And what we did was we added support in ADFS as well as in our PowerShell module for a switch called support multiple domain. That support multiple domain switch allows or effectively generates an issuer URI based off the UPN of the user, allowing us then to support many issuers coming from the same ADFS server. And there's no scale issues around that. It's basically a small calculation that the ADFS server does during logon. So if you're in that situation, you need to make sure you use that switch, otherwise you will get into problems. As it says there, there is some additional work for subdomains. If you have multiple top-level domains with subdomains. And if you do, please come by and see me and we'll walk through that. If you're a multi-forest customer, not multiple domains in a single forest is fine, but if you have truly multiple forests, there's some work that we go through, so contact your Microsoft representative and we can help you get through how that program works. And multi-forest would include resource forest. User account and then a resource forest would be an example of a common multi-forest deployment. So strong authentication. So there's a couple of options here for strong authentication. How many people have a strong authentication type requirement? A few. Okay. So we focused on sort of two areas for strong authentication. One was I want to make sure that externally, whenever anybody connects through, I want to make sure that I challenge for strong credentials. And this is really focused on sort of the web-based clients. Okay? Or if I want the richer set of clients to work, I'll focus on sort of VPNing them into the network. So effectively pulling them through a strong VPN into my network. In the first model, with just web-based clients, there is no support for rich clients in that model. And the second one really provides that. So let's walk through what that looks like. If I configure the web-based clients only, what I'm effectively doing is, out of the box, if I use smart cards, ADFS 2.0 can support that on the proxy server. If not, I got the option of adding an additional 2FA either by use of the HTTP module that I can plug into IIS, or I can customize that forms logon page in order to redirect me to somewhere else. Sort of the code behind approach. And as I said, there's no rich clients. So effectively what I've got is the authentication platform in the cloud there and SharePoint Online. It's a good example. And we'll deal with the simple case, the smart code case. So I've got my ADFS proxy and I've got my user with a browser. They're going to follow that same sort of dance. They've accessed the SharePoint Online application. They get redirected up to the authentication platform, Realm Discovery, and end up back at the ADFS proxy. And in this case, the ADFS proxy is going to prompt them for, hey, give me your smart card. When they get that smart card, they'll provide that smart card credential. They get their token, they go back, present it, and then they get access to the system. In the case where I have a different type, and we have an example within the public documentation under the advanced configuration settings to configure RSA, secure ID for this. And it's a very similar dance. You have a 2FA service with a 2FA plug-on, if you will, to the bottom of the ADFS server. You go through the same dance. But this time when I hit the IDP, it'll either redirect me across to the strong auth provider, or it can do it within the forms logon page if I'm doing code behind. And then I present my strong credentials to it. Once I've presented those credentials, I authenticate with my 2FA. I get back to the proxy, giving it the token I got. It authenticates that response, does the lookup for me, and allows me to get back to the authentication platform and eventually over to the system. No support for our rich clients there. So if I need rich client support and I want to roll through this, then I can go through effectively a VPN gateway to get in. Okay. So effectively what I'm trying to do is take my external user and pull them inside the corporate network. So I integrated 2FA or a strong authentication set up with my VPN provider. And then I effectively, because of the way that Outlook works, I need to add my location isolation there so that I can define where Outlook can work from. So again, we're combining sort of two technologies here together. One, the VPN in, and the second being isolation of where Outlook runs from. We can also do additional things such as allowing EAS, again using those client isolation policies. And we get that support for rich clients now, because I've effectively pulled you into the corporate network. So that, what does that look like for us? So firstly, I want to configure effectively Outlook or ActiveSync clients to work. And because we know the way they work, I can disable the passive pages on the proxy so that there's nothing, no way that anybody can get a token from the passive endpoint. These two then send their credentials, and we go through that proxy auth dance, and effectively they send it, request the ADFS active endpoint. I apply my rules that say, is the client internal or external? Is it what type of client it is? What endpoint are they connecting to? And I decide that whether or not to issue a token to those endpoints. The next option I come up with is now I got these strong clients. So I deploy my strong clients, my rich clients out there are sitting out in the cloud. I put in my VPN with its 2FA solution. I connect my PC effectively, connects my PC to the VPN. That authenticates and gets me back into the corporate network. Now, whenever I try and access using Link or any of the web clients or even Outlook, I'm going to effectively either hit the ADFS server internally immediately, or I'm going to roll through the Exchange proxy auth, but I'll have an internal IP for that network. That brings me to the end of my section of this, I guess, and ready for any questions you may have around any of the subjects we've covered today. So the question is, if I'm just using Link Online and I'm just using Exchange Online, do I need the sign-in assistant deployed on all the machines? And the technical answer is no. It doesn't interact with any of those clients. However, we probably will recommend that you install it if you want to expand on that. For example, if you have Exchange Online and Link on premises, then there is some interaction in those areas. So when will we support SAML 2, and when will all of them support single sign-on? That's a doubly loaded question. So support for SAML 2 is something that we're working through. All right. The problem with support for SAML 2, and the reason it's not in the deck here, is that we don't currently support or won't support anything other than sort of potentially web-based clients and the Exchange client, okay, which is a limitation. So things like Link probably won't work initially. No commitment either way there on when it comes through, but it's the SAML 2 client has trouble with rich clients. The SAML 2 protocol and rich clients don't get on. The second question, I think, is around when do we get true single sign-on across all of the applications? When do I stop getting prompted for at least username and password by Outlook is probably the question. We've taken a lot of feedback on that, and at this stage, I don't know when we will fix that particular issue. It's a challenging issue for us in the sense that we need to be able to support a wide range of clients in Exchange Online. So proxy auth allows us to support all the clients in a consistent way. Dealing with Outlook as a separate entity is more difficult. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what about using certs? This is something that, again, these are sort of scenarios that we get feedback from other customers saying, hey, I'm you know, I could provision a certificate onto my phone. How can you make that actually work for us? Certificating has its set of challenges as well for the devices. What we would effectively have to do is be able to verify that the certificate matches what we want and be able to verify the trust chain of it, which is a difficult thing to do in an online service, but it's certainly something that we've had a number of customers request in order to be able to get past either username and password, making sure that they own the device, and that it was a corporate-issued device because only those would have certificates associated with them, as well as strengthening the authentication flow to make them work better. As an example, Link actually uses certificates under the hood as well. So it is something that we've considered. I don't have any particular timelines or any commitment that we'll move down that path. So Windows Server 2012, yes, it does come with ADFS. It's an updated version of ADFS 2.0. It will work with the same tooling that we have, where we worked with the ADFS team to make sure that our PowerShell modules and the Server 2012 version of ADFS, so you don't need to download a new one, will work with the existing tools. Sorry, I'm... So the question is, I want to limit DirSync to a set of users, not all users. It's something that we actually have on the drawing board. It's look for something soon. I don't know exactly how long soon will be, but it is definitely something we're working through. The problem with filtering that we have is that customers have implemented filtering in the past, which is not supported today. Unfortunately, what tends to happen is they then ring us up and say, I put a filter on and I filtered out, you know, 800-odd users or an OU or something of this nature that just happen to have mailboxes. Can you help me get them back? All right. So it's kind of a loaded gun, and we don't like giving loaded guns to customers. So until we put the safety on it, we're not going to support filtering. What we're effectively doing is building that safety net so that if you do that, you'll automatically, when you change the filter and things fall out of scope, and we believe it's a delete, you can auto-recover from that without having to ring up. So there's some work that needs to happen before we want to, you know, effectively support it. But it shouldn't be too far away. So what if I'm already using FIM for Find Identity Manager? Do I need to add DirSync? And the answer is yes, right? We don't have a plug-in process yet for FIM, all right? We do use FIM under the hood, but it's a slightly packaged version, I'll call it, of FIM. Can we provision from FIM direct into the from one FIM to the other? Yeah. Unfortunately, no. We will only read through AD. So you have to provision into AD and we'll read from there. Yeah, there's no... We don't have any great smarts around those yet. Okay. How... Oh, how do we safely handle username changes? So as I said, so that user source ID, this unique never-changing value, is something that Directory Sync also uses. And as I said, it's your 80 object GUID base64 encoded. And because it's not something that the user can ever edit, and it's never-changing across, you know, as you move users around, in, even within a single forest, they'll move around domains, we'll keep that 80 object GUID. Because of that, that allows us to make sure that any other changes go through. So if we were to use, say, UPN, you're right. UPN changed, how would we ever know what it was supposed to be previously in the cloud? So that's why we use these unique never-changing values. So 80 object GUID is a really good example of a never-changing, guaranteed to be unique value. So that's how we maintain that relationship is you can change any value and we'll pick that up because we link on that AD object GUID. Okay. Any other questions? If you do have other questions, I'll be down in the booth. And thank you very much. Hope you all enjoy the rest of the conference. I should say there's an evals somewhere in here. Where is it? Hold on. There it is.